Hey you guys, and welcome back to my channel.
Sorry it's been a while.
I've been struggling with some health problems, but we're going to figure out that later. Today I'm coming at you with one true crime case and one scary story. So you're in for a wild treat. Today we're going to talk about the kidnapping of ...11-year-old J.C. Lee Dugard. Everybody around the true crime community pretty well knows this case. So I'm going to dive right in. On June 10th, 1991, J.C. Lee Dugard, an 11-year-old girl, was abducted from a street while walking to a school bus stop in Myers, California, United States. Searches began immediately after Dugard's disappearance, but no reliable leads were generated, even though several people witnessed the kidnapping. Dugard remained missing for over 18 years until 2009, when a convicted sex offender, Philip Garrado, visited the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, accompanied by two adolescent girls, who were discovered to be the biological daughters of Garrado and Dugard on August 24th and 25th of that year. The unusual behavior of the trio sparked an investigation that led Garrado's parole officer, Edward Santos Jr., to order Garrado to take the two girls to a parole office in Concord, California on August 26th. Garrado was accompanied by a woman who was eventually identified as J.C. Lee Dugard. Garrado and his wife Nancy were arrested after Dugard's reappearance. On April 28, 2011, they pleaded guilty to kidnapping and raping Dugard. Investigators revealed that Dugard had been kept in concealed tents, sheds, and lean toes in an area behind the Garrado's house at 1554 Walnut Avenue in Antioch, California. Did I pronounce that wrong? Most probably. Where Philip repeatedly raped Dugard during the first 6 years of her captivity. During her confinement, Dugard gave birth to two daughters, who were aged 11 and 15 at the time of Dugard's reappearance. On June 2nd, 2011, Garrado was sentenced to 431 years to life imprisonment. His wife, Nancy, was sentenced to 36 to life. Philip is a person of interest in at least one other missing person case in the San Francisco Bay Area. As Garrado had been on parole for a 1976 rape at the time of her kidnapping, Dugard sued the state of California, which had taken over his parole supervision from the federal government in 1999, on account of the numerous lapses by law enforcement that contributed to her continued captivity and sexual assault. In 2010, the state of California awarded the Dugard family $20 million U.S. Dugard also sued the federal government on similar grounds pertaining to Garrado's time as a federal parolee. But in a 2-1 ruling, the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed the suit, because Garrado had not victimized her at the time he was placed under the supervision of the federal parole system, and that as a result of this, quotations, there was no way to anticipate she would become his victim, end quote. In 2011, Dugard wrote an autobiography titled A Stolen Life, a memoir. Her second book, Freedom, My Book of Firsts, was published in 2016. Now, I'm going to give you a little background on JC. JC Dugo's biological father, Ken Slayton, was not involved in her life, nor in the investigation that followed her kidnapping. When Dugo was 7, her mother, Terry, married a carpet contractor named Carl Probe and gave birth to Dugard's half-sister, Shayna, in 1989. Although Dugard was close to her mother and sister, she was never close to Proben. In September 1990, Dugard's family moved from Acadia, California, to Los Angeles County, to Myers, a rural town south of South Lake Tahoe. Because they thought it was a safer community at the time, at the time of the abduction, Dugard was in the fifth grade and anticipated an upcoming field trip. Her kidnappers. The primary offender, Philip Greg Guerrero, was born in Pittsburgh, California on April 5th, 1951. He grew up in Brentwood, where he graduated from Liberty High School in 1969. Guerrero's father, Manuel, later stated that his son had been a good boy as a child, but changed radically after a serious motorcycle incident as a teenager. He turned to drug use, primarily methamphetamine and LSD. Before I continue, do you notice how it's always a problem, like an accident that these killers have, like a head trauma or something like that? Just always something to do with that. In later court testimony, Guerrero admitted that he habitually masturbated in his car by the side of the elementary and high school while watching girls. Oh, creep. In 1972, he was arrested and charged with repeatedly raping a 14-year-old girl after giving her barbiturates. Okay. But the case did not go to trial after the girl declined to testify. Oh my God, he's scared. The following year, he married his high school classmate, Christine Murphy, who accused him of domestic violence and alleged that he kidnapped her when she tried to leave him. In 1976, Guerrero kidnapped 25-year-old Catherine Calloway in South Lake Tahoe, California. He took her to a Reno, Nevada warehouse where he raped her for 5.5 hours. When a police officer noticed a car parked outside the warehouse and then a broken lock on its door, he knocked on the door and was greeted by Guerrero. Calloway then emerged and asked for help. Greta was promptly arrested. In the 1976 court-ordered psychiatric evaluation, Greta was diagnosed as a sexual deviant and chronic drug abuser. The psychiatrist recommended that a neurological examination be conducted, as Greta's chronic drug use could be responsible in part of his mixed or multiple sexual deviance. He was evaluated by neurologist Albert F. Peterman, whose diagnostic impression was that Guerrero showed considerable evidence of anxiety and depression and personality disorder. He was convicted on March 9, 1977, and began serving a 50-year federal sentence on June 30th of that year at Leavenworth Penitentiary in Kansas. At Leavenworth, Guerrero met Nancy Bocangera, the secondary offender in Dugard's kidnapping, who was visiting her uncle, another prisoner. On October 5th, 1981, he and Nancy were married at the prison. On January 22, 1988, Guerrero was released from Leavenworth to Nevada State Prison, where he served 7 months of a 5-years-to-life Nevada sentence. He was transferred to federal parole authorities in Contra Costa County, California, on August 26, 1988. Gerdo and his wife moved to the city of Anchnich and lived in the home of his elderly mother, who suffered from dementia. As a parolee, Gerdo wore a GPS-enabled ankle bracelet and was regularly visited by parole officers, local sheriff's deputies, and federal agents. On June 10th, 1991, Duguid's mother, who worked as a typesetter at a print house, left for work early in the day. Duguid was, who was 11 at the time, wore her favorite all-pink outfit as she walked up the hill from her house and against traffic to catch the school bus. When she was halfway up the hill, a gray car approached her. She thought the man driving the car was stopping to ask for directions. The driver, Philip Garrido, pulled down the window and tased Duguid unconscious with a stun gun before abducting her. His wife, Nancy, dragged Duguid into the car and removed her clothing, leaving only a butterfly-shaped ring that Duguid would take and hide from them for the next 18 years. Nancy covered Duguid with a blanket and held her down as Duguid drifted in and out of consciousness. During the three-hour drive to the Gorilla's property, 120 miles away in Anchnich, the only time Duguid spoke was when she pleaded that her parents could not afford a ransom. The district attorney's office in the Duguid's case believed that Nancy had scolded Duguid as a prize for Gerrito. Krogan witnessed the abduction of his stepdaughter from within sight of their home. He saw two people in a mid-sized gray car, possibly a Mercury Monarch, make a U-turn at the school bus stop where Duguid was waiting, and a woman forcing Duguid into the car. He chased after them on a bike, but was unable to overtake the vehicle. Some of Duguid's classmates were also witnesses to the abduction. Initial suspects included Proben and Ken Slayton, Duguid's biological father. Though they did not know each other, and Slayton had only had a brief relationship with Duguid's mother in 1979, not knowing he had a child. Krogan took and passed several polygraph tests, and Slayton was also quickly cleared of suspicion. The kidnapper led to the breakup of Terry and Krogan's marriage. Within hours of Duguid's disappearance, local and national media on South Lake Tahoe covered the story. Within days, dozens of local volunteers assisted in the search effort, which involved nearly every resource within the community. Within weeks, tens of thousands of flyers and posters were mailed to the businesses throughout the United States. St. Duguid's favorite color was pink. The town was blanketed in pink ribbons as a reminder of her disappearance and as a demonstration of support for her family by the community. Terry Proben founded a group called JC's Hope, which directed the volunteer and fundraising efforts. Cassette tapes of the song JC Lee, along with t-shirts, sweatshirts, and buttons, was sold to raise money for poster materials, postage, printing, and related expenses. Child Quest International and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children were involved in an effort. A reward was offered, which was noted on the posters and flyers. The kidnapping case attracted nationwide attention and was featured on the June 14, 1991 episode of the Fox television show, America's Most Wanted. The ensuing years were a continuous effort for child safety awareness, fundraising events, and candlelight vigils, making Dugard's disappearance, keeping her story in the public awareness. Upon arriving at the Garrido's home in an unincorporated area of Antsnich, the Garrido's took Dugard, her head still covered with a blanket, behind their house where they had constructed a series of dilapidated tents and sheds. Garrido placed Dugard inside a tiny shed that had been soundproofed. Dugard later stated in her memoir and an interview with ABC News that upon arrival, Garrido handcuffed her and left her naked in the shed, which he bolted shut, warning her that trained Doberman outside the shed would attack if she tried to escape. Right after the abduction, Garrido forced Dugard in a shower with him, which was the first time she had exposed to an unclothed man. During her first week in captivity, Dugard remained in handcuffs. Her only human contact being Garrido, who sometimes brought her fast food and talked to her. He provided a bucket for her to use to relieve herself. A week after the kidnapping, Garrido raped the still handcuffed Dugard for the first time. He continued to rape her frequently, doing so at least once a week for the first 3 years of her captivity. At one point, Garrido provided Dugard with a television, but she could not watch the news and remained unaware of the search for her. Almost a month and a half after her kidnapping, by Dugard's regulation, Garrido moved her into a larger room next door, where she was handcuffed to a bed. He explained that the demon angels let him take her and that she would help him with his sexual problems because society had ignored him. Garrido would occasionally go to dates, long methamphetamine binges he called runs. During which he would force Dugard to keep him company by performing sexual favors and engaging in various other activities with him. Garrido made her listen out of the voices he said he could hear from the walls and often professed a belief that he was a chosen servant of God. These binges would end with Garrido sobbing and apologizing to Jason, alternating with threats to sell her to people who would put her in a cage. 7 months into her captivity, Garrido introduced Dugard to his wife, Nancy, who brought the child a stuffed animal and a chocolate milk and engaged in the same tearful apologies to her. Though Dugard craved the woman's approval at the time, in a 2011 ABC News interview, she stated that Nancy was just as manipulative as Garrido. Dugard relayed that Nancy alternated between motherly concern and coldness and cruelty, expressing her jealousy of Dugard, whom she regarded as the one to blame for her predicament. She characterized Nancy, who worked as a nursing home aide, as evil and twisted. When Garrido was returned to prison for failing a drug test, Nancy replaced her husband as Dugard's jailer. The Garrido's neighbor, Patrick McQuaid, told the San Jose Mercury News that as a child, he recalled meeting Duver through a fence in the girl's yard soon after the kidnapping. He said that she had identified herself by the name Tracy, and that when asked if she lived there or was just visiting, her answered that she lived there. At that point, Gerardo came out and took her back indoors. He eventually built an 8-foot-tall, 2.4-meter fence around the backyard and set up a tent for Dugard. The first time that she was allowed to walk outside since her kidnapping. The Gerardos manipulated Dugard further by presenting her on two occasions with kittens that would later mysteriously vanish. When Gerardo discovered that she was signing her real name in a journal that she kept about the kittens, she was forced to tear out the page with her name on it, and the last time she would be permitted to say or write her name until her captivity ended 18 years later. She was never allowed to see a doctor or a dentist. Almost 3 years into her captivity, the Gerardos began to allow Dugard freedom from her handcuffed periods, while they kept her locked in her bolted room. On Easter Sunday of 1994, they gave her cooked food for the first time. The couple informed Dugard that they believed that she was pregnant. Dugard, aged 13 at the time, had learned of the link between sex and pregnancy from television. Dugard watched television programs on childbirth in preparation for the birth of her first daughter, which occurred when Dugard was only 14, on August 18, 1994. After the birth of her first daughter, Gerard raped Dugard less frequently, though he would nonetheless do so when he had taken drugs. The last time Gerardo raped Dugard was the day her second daughter was conceived. Her second daughter was born when Dugard was 17, on November 13, 97. Dugard took care of her daughters using information learned from television and worked to protect them from Gerardo, who continued his enraged rants and lectures. Dugard coped with her continued captivity by planting flowers in a garden and homeschooling her daughters. At one point, Gerardo informed Dugard that to pacify his wife, Dugard and her daughters were to address Nancy as their mother, and that she was to teach her daughters that Dugard was their older sister. When Dugard and her daughters were eventually allowed to come into contact with other people, this fiction was continued. Gerardo opened a print shop where Dugard acted as the graphic artist. Ben Dodrill, a customer of Gerardo's printing business, claimed that he met and spoke by telephone with Dugard and that she did excellent work. During this time, Dugard had access to the business phone and an email account. Another customer indicated that she never hinted to him about her childhood abduction or her true identity. Witnesses stated Dugard was seen in the Gerardo household and sometimes answered the front door to talk to people, but she never stated there was a problem or attempted to leave with her. While the family kept to themselves, the girls were sometimes seen playing in the secondary backyard and behind the house, where Dugard's living quarters are thought to have been located. The private area of the backyard included sheds, one of which was used as a recording studio in which Gerardo recorded himself singing religious-themed and romantic country songs. Two homemade tents and what has been described as a camping-style shower and toilet. The area was surrounded by tall trees and a 6-foot, 1.8-meter high fence. An entrance to the secondary backyard was covered by trees and a trampoline. privacy was enhanced by tents and outbuildings. The electricity was supplied by extension cords. The enclosure also housed a car that matched the description of the one used in the abduction. Law enforcement officers visited the residence at least twice, but did not ask to inspect the backyard and did not detect the presence of Dugan or her children in the areas of the property that they did inspect. There were among several missed opportunities for rescue, which later led to criticism of authorities. Police failed to realize that Dugard had been kidnapped south of Lake Tahoe, the same location as Gerda's 1976 kidnapping and rape of Catherine Calloway Hall. On April 22, 1992, less than a year after her kidnapping, a man called the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department from a gas station less than 2 miles from the Gerda's home, reporting that he saw Dugard inside the gas station staring intently at a missing child poster of herself. The caller then reported seeing her leave in a large yellow van, possibly a Dodge. An old yellow Dodge van was later recovered from the Gerda property that matched the description of the van given in the call. The license plate was not reported in the 1992 call. The caller, the girl, and the van were gone by the time police arrived. The caller never identified himself, and the police did not pursue the matter. Contradicting the story, Dugard reported that she never left the Gerda property from the day she was kidnapped until shortly before her first child was born in August of 1994. In June of 2002, the Anna Fire Department responded to a report of a juvenile with a shoulder injury that occurred in a swimming pool at the Gerda's home. This information was not relayed to the parole office, which had no record of either a juvenile or a swimming pool at their address. In 2006, one of the Gerda's neighbors called 911 to inform them that there were tents in the backyard with children living there, and that Gerda was psychotic with sexual addictions. A deputy sheriff spoke with Gerda at the front of the house for about 30 minutes and left. After telling Gerda that there would be a code violation if people were living outside on the property. After Dugard was found, in August 2009, the local Contra Costa County Sheriff Warren E. Ruff issued an apology to the victims in a new conference. On November 4th, 2009, the California Office of the Inspector General issued a report that enumerated lapses by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitations that had been contributed to Dugard's continued captivity. The central finding was that Gerda was incorrectly classified as needing only low-level supervision. All other lapses derived from that mistake. In his report, the Inspector General detailed an incident in which a parole agent encountered a 12-year-old girl at the home but accepted Gerda's explanation that she was his brother's daughter, and the agent did nothing to verify it, even though a call to Gerda's brother verified that he did not have children. On August 24th, 2009, Gerda visited the San Francisco office at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, also known as the FBI, and left a 4-page essay containing his ideas about religion and sexuality, suggesting that he had discovered a solution to problem behaviors like his past crimes. The essay described how he had cured his deviant behavior and how the information could be used to assist in curing the sexual predators by controlling human impulses that drive human to communicate dysfunctional acts. On the same day, Barreto traveled to the University of California, UC Berkeley, with Dugard's two daughters and visited its campus police office seeking permission to hold a special event as part of his God's Desires program. He spoke with special events manager Lisa Campbell. She perceived his behavior as erratic and felt that the girls were sullen and submissive. She asked Garrido to make an appointment for the next day, which he did, leaving his name in the process. Officer Ali Jacobs ran a background check and discovered that Garrido was a registered sex offender on federal parole for kidnapping and rape. Nice. Garrido and the girls returned for their appointment at 2 p.m. the following day, and Jacobs attended the meeting. The girls appeared to Jacobs to be as pale as they had not been exposed to sunlight, and she felt that their behavior was unusual. Garrido's several parole violations were a basis for an arrest, so Jacobs phoned the parole office to relay her concerns, leaving a report on voicemail. After hearing Jacob's recorded messages, two parole agents drove to the Garrido's house later that day. Upon arrival, they handcuffed Garrido and searched the house, finding only his wife, Nancy, and his elderly mother at home. The parole agents then drove him to the parole office. En route, Garrido said that the girls who had accompanied him to the UC Berkeley were the daughters of a relative, and that he had permission from their parents to take them there. Although the parole office had previously barred Greta from associating with minors, and Berkeley was 40 miles, 64 kilometers from the Garrido's Contra Costa residence, 15 miles over the 25-mile limit he was allowed to travel from his home without the parole agent's permission, nothing was done about these violations. After reviewing his file with a supervisor, they drove Garrido home and ordered him to report to the office again the next day to discuss the visit to UC Berkeley and to follow up on the office's concerns about the two girls. Garrido arrived at the parole office in Concord, California on August 26th with Nancy, the two girls, and Dugard, who was introduced as Alyssa. The parole officer decided to separate Garrido from the woman and girls to obtain their identification. Maintaining her false identity as Alyssa, Dugard told investigators that the girls were her daughters, although she indicated that she was aware that Garrido was a convicted sex offender. She stated that he was a changed man, a great person, and was good with her kids. Comments that were echoed by the two girls. When pressed for details that would confirm her identity, Dugard became extremely defensive and agitated, demanding to know why she was being interrogated, and subsequently stated that she was a battered wife from Minnesota and hiding from her abusive husband. The parole officer eventually called the Concord police. Upon the arrival of a Concord police sergeant, Garrido admitted he had kidnapped and raped Dugard. Only after this did she properly identify herself as J.C. Dugard. It was later suggested that Dugard showed signs of Stockholm Syndrome. In 2016, ABC News interview Dugard stated that her compassion and willingness to interact with the captor were her only means of surviving, saying the phrase Stockholm Syndrome implies that hostages packed by terror and abuse become affectionate towards their captors. Well, it's degrading, you know? Having my family believe that I was in love with the captor and wanting to stay with him. I mean, that is so far from the truth, and that it makes me want to throw up. I adapted to survive my circumstances. She repeatedly stated that as a survival mechanism, many victims are forced to sympathize with their captors. Greta and his wife were placed under arrest. An FBI special agent put Dugard on the telephone with her mother, Terry Probin. Dugard retained custody of her children and reunited with her mother on August 27, 2009. Dugard's aunt, Tina Dugard, and a former business associate of the Gerdos, Siobhan Molino, have commented that Dugard's children looked healthy. Tina said that upon her meeting them after their escape, they always appeared and behaved like normal kids. Molina said of the times that she met them while they were in captive, that in her presence, they never acted robotically and did not wear unusual clothing. In the days following Dugard's return, her stepfather confirmed that Dugard and her daughter were in good health and intelligent. Their reunion was going well, and they were proceeding slowly. He said Dugard had developed a significant emotional bond with Greta, and the two daughters cried when they learned of their father's arrest. Tina Dugard reported that the daughters are clever, articulate, and curious girls. Ernie Allen, president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, said Dugard's reappearance is an important event for families of other long-term missing children because it shows the hope remains even in long-term cases. Abduction survivor Elizabeth Smart has stressed the importance of focusing on the future with a positive attitude as an effective approach to accepting what has happened. Sean Hornbeck, another abducting survivor, also commented on the case, noting, coming out of what she's had to endure is like entering a new world. It's like a door has opened for her and she's emerged from a world that's black and white into one that's full of color. The opinion that the reason Dugard never escaped of her own accord was that she was brainwashed. He further offered insight into post-abduction life, saying, that feeling of anger are normal for survivors, and that therapy can enable them to move on with their lives. 3 weeks after her release, Dugard asked for her pets that were raised in the home. On October 14, 2009, People magazine published the first verified photo of J.C. Dugard as an adult on its cover. Dugard's memoir, A Stolen Life, a memoir, is published on July 12, 2011 by Simon and Schuster to positive reviews. Dugard began animal-assisted therapy with horses, and actively she shared with her mother, Terry, and her sister, Shayna. Following the arrest, police searched the Gerdo home extensively for evidence of other crimes. Because Gerdo had access to his neighbor's house, it was also searched for evidence. Police also searched the homes and businesses of one of Gerdo's printing business clients. Police agencies from Hayward and Dublin, California, conducted searches of the Gerdo's property for evidence pertaining to missing girls from those communities, but did not find any. In July 2011, Hayward police announced that Gueto has not been eliminated as a suspect and is still a person of interest in the abduction case of Michaela Garrett. Garrett was kidnapped in 1988, and Hayward is 55 miles, 89 kilometers, from the Gueto's Anik home. On August 27, 2009, KCRA-TV in Sacramento, California, interviewed Gueto in his jail cell by telephone. During the interview, Gueto said, "In the end, this is going to be a powerful, heartwarming story because of his version of events. My life has been straightened out. Wait till you hear the story of what took place at this house. You're going to be absolutely impressed. It's a disgusting thing that took place with me at the beginning, but I turned myself completely around." Gueto repeatedly told the reporter how he filed documents with the FBI on August 24th, 2009, which, when they were published, would cause people to fall over backwards, and that he could not reveal more because he had to protect law enforcement. And what happened was something that humans have not understood well. In the interview, Gueto denied he had ever harmed Dugard's two daughters. He said that their births changed his life, saying, "They slept in my arms every single night since birth. I never touched them." On August 28, 2009, FBI spokesman Joseph Schrader confirmed that Gueto had indeed left the documents with the agency. As he claimed, but declined to discuss further details. The document titled "Origin of Schizophrenia Revealed" was eventually released by the FBI. It is about stopping schizophrenics from turning violent and controlling sounds with the human mind. On August 28, 2009, Gueto and his wife pled not guilty to charges including kidnapping, rape, and false imprisonment. The case was prosecuted in El Dorado County by elected district attorney Vern R. Pearson and assistant DA James A. Clitchard. A bail preliminary hearing was held September 14, 2009, at the El Dorado County Superior Court in Placerville, California. At the hearing, Superior Court Judge Douglas Pimster set bail for Nancy at $30 million U.S. There was a no bail parole hold on Dorado. The judge initially kept Nancy in custody on a no bail hold, but she was granted bail at a later date. At the September 14th hearing, Pimster also granted a request from Gueto's attorney to have a psychologist or a psychiatric appointed to conduct a confidential evaluation. Such examinations can be used by the defense to assist in case preparation, and additional mental health examinations can be ordered at subsequent phases in the proceedings. On October 29, 2009, a short hearing was held to set a date for the next preliminary hearing, when issues such as discovery were to be discussed. This hearing occurred on December 11, 2009. Katie Calloway Hall, whom Gueto kidnapped and raped in 1976, appeared in the courtroom at the October and December hearings. She did not speak during either preliminary hearings. On November 5th, 2009, Pimster ordered Nancy's defense attorney, Gilbert Means, to be removed from the case. According to a posting on the court's website, The decision occurred in a review of confidential evidence that has not been disclosed to the public, and details of the proceedings were kept sealed. The decision was stayed until November 3rd, 2009. On November 12th, 2009, Grimsey appointed Stephen A. Tapson an interim counsel for Nancy. Gilbert Mays appealed the decision and received a favorable ruling by the California Third District Court of Appeal on December 15, 2009. On December 22, 2009, the same court gave the El Dorado Superior Court until January 2010 to respond to the ruling. Both Gilbert Mays and Stephen Townsend appeared at the discovery hearing on December 11, 2009. A hearing was held on January 21, 2010. At that hearing, Mains was removed from the case and Tapson was appointed defense counsel for Nancy. Condition bail in the amount of $20 million was set for Nancy. At a press conference on February 28, 2011, Tapson said that Nancy and Philip Gerardo had both made a full confession in the case. The development came as lawyers for both sides reopened discussions on a possible plea deal that had the potential to accommodate the need for a trial. Nancy's attorney acknowledged that she was facing a 241-year, 8 months to life, and that he was working for a reduced sentence in the 30-year range. He stated that the prosecutor had acknowledged that Philip was a master manipulator and that Nancy was under both his influence and that of substances during the period of Dugard's kidnapping, so should receive some consideration while alluding to parallels with kidnap victim Patty Hearst and Stockholm Syndrome. On April 7, 2011, instead of pleading guilty, as had been expected based on the previous statements, the Griddles pleaded not guilty to charges of kidnapping and raping Dugard, as well as other charges in an amended grand jury indictment. Philip's attorney, public defender Susan Gilman, alleged that the grand jury might have been selected improperly and might have acted improperly. Gilman did not elaborate on her claim in the courtroom, but said outside that she had questions of both the racial and geographic makeup of the grand jury that originally indicted the Garridos in September 2010. Judge Pinfer noted that there were issues about the process itself before the grand jury and also stated that the court would consider whether the grand jury acted appropriately. These developments were largely unforeseen by attorney Stephen Tapson, who represented Nancy. Tapson said earlier that week that Philip had made a deal with prosecutors to plead guilty and spend the rest of his life in prison. Gilman was upset with Tapson for telling reporters that her client had planned to plead guilty, saying that he should only speak about his own client. Nancy Tapson said he found out about Gilman's plans only late on April 6. Neither attorney would elaborate further on the specific concerns about the grand jury. El Dorado, California District Attorney Vern Pearson said he did not think the complaints about the grand jury would ultimately derail the case against the Gerardos. On April 28, 2011, the Gerardos pled guilty to kidnapping and rape by force. On June 2, 2011, Philip was sentenced to 431 years to life imprisonment. Nancy was sentenced to 36 years to life imprisonment. The sentence would allow Nancy to be eligible for parole in August 2029. Philip was imprisoned in California State Prison, Corcoran, while Nancy was incarcerated at Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. Dugard did not attend the sentencing, instead sending a written message with her mother to read aloud in court. And that's the end of the case. Hope you enjoyed it.